This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we start our show with North Dakota's Teacher of the Year for 2021. Christy Reinke teaches geography at Jim Hill Middle School in Minot. Thanks for being with us today, Christy.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a big honor, and you were just recently named the Teacher of the Year. When and how did you learn about this?
Well, I actually learned that I was a finalist a few weeks ago, and then the Department of Public Instruction and Superintendent Basler came to my school last week and presented the finalist award, so I got to share that with my coworkers and my students. And then this past Monday, I was invited down to the state capitol, and Superintendent Basler and Governor Burgum presented me with the honor of being the Teacher of the Year for North Dakota.
Well, what does the honor entail? The title sounds pretty wonderful in itself.
Right. Well, you know, there's a whole platform now. You know, I get to go out and I get to advocate for teachers. I get to advocate for North Dakota schools. It's just a really great way for people to see all the exciting and wonderful things that educators are doing every day in the classroom. So that's the biggest takeaway for me, is making sure that I get to yell from the rooftops, you know, how great and hardworking my coworkers and my fellow educators are.
Tell us your story, Christy. How did you come to education?
Well, actually, it's funny you say that. I mean, it's for me growing up, I never really had education as far as being a teacher when I grew up. I always wanted to do something in perhaps the criminal justice field. I started kind of dabbling a little bit in the political field when I was at college. And so shortly after I graduated from Minot State University, I actually ended up moving out to Washington, D.C. and working for one of our North Dakota, one of our United States senators for North Dakota. And so I really had aspirations of living there and sort of being in, you know, the political arena somewhere. However, then I was out there during 9/11.
Oh.
So once that happened, you know, my whole real perspective on life kind of just changed, and priorities for me started becoming more toward, I need to be home with my family. I wanted to be closer to my loved ones, to my roots. And so I ended up coming home, I believe in October of that year. And then when I got home, I kind of thought, now what? I had a degree in criminal justice. And after seeing what the amazing law enforcement and everybody, what they had done right after 9/11, I kind of thought, you know, I just don't know if I could do that. It wasn't really in the cards for me. So at the time, but he was already an educator, as well as his parents. And I just had a lot of friends and family that were just such influential educators. And I thought, you know, maybe that's where I belong. So ended up going back to college and getting my education degree. And the rest is kind of history, I guess.
Well, you move from criminology, though, to geography. You teach geography, which is more than maps. So
right.
Tell our listeners why geography education is important.
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, my degree is in social sciences, and I just love that whole aspect of all the different classes of social sciences, you know, criminal justice, sociology, psychology, all the history classes. And so when a geography opportunity came up for me, I just jumped at the chance to get to learn something new. I actually taught in special education for my first 7 years. And so it wasn't until my eighth year of education that this opportunity for geography came up. But I jumped at the chance and I have never looked back. I mean, geography to me is this class where we just get to explore. There's not necessarily a set stepping stone that we have to follow. We can do so many things that are current right now that's going on in the world. And we get to play around a little bit with it and do some pretty exciting things that perhaps you couldn't do in, you know, another class. So we get to study cultures around the world. We get to study current events. So much more than just maps and locations.
Well, I have a brother and a sister-in-law who are both advanced degree geographers, and their specialty is climate science. It's a broad spectrum. How has the pandemic affected you, your home life and your professional life?
Well, I have three children that are in the school system already. My daughter's in fifth grade this year. I have twin sons. They're in 10th grade this year. So when the pandemic hit, I was actually on the way home from bringing a group of about 30 eighth grade students to Washington, D.C. to visit the Capitol. We were probably one of the last groups to get to tour there. We ended up landing in Minneapolis about 10 o'clock on that Sunday night, where all of a sudden everybody's phones just started pinging, you know, from their families at home saying, there's no school tomorrow. The governor called off school. And so I remember we got home about midnight and thought, oh boy, what's going to happen tomorrow morning? And so with my three children already being in education, and my husband, also a teacher, the five of us just kind of woke up that next day and went, well, let's find out what our next path is. And so my husband and I went to school the next day and scrambled with, you know, our amazing coworkers and really, truly recreated education, as, you know, we all found out shortly after. And so the five of us and our family, we just dove in and we just did what we needed to do to stay safe and to, you know, finish last year's education.
Well, a lot of students are opting for at-home instruction, that is going online to get their classwork done. How about your kids? Are they at school or are they at home?
You know, my kids are at school. You know, I know that they were at the age where they could probably stay home. They were fairly successful during last spring's session, but they just craved being around people. They wanted to be around their friends. You know, my own children, they were so good about wearing masks, and they were so good about, you know, social distancing. And I thought, you know what? Let's get them back in there. I worried about students, including my own children, their mental health. They are such social creatures, you know, that they craved it. And so my husband and I did. We sat down and we made a decision, and they're in school full time, and they are loving being back with their classmates and in Minot Public Schools where my kids attend and we teach. We have a plan, and everybody is so good at sticking to this plan and just doing everything they can do to be able to continue going to school face-to-face.
Christy Reinke is the 2021 North Dakota Teacher of the Year. She teaches at Jim Hill Middle School in Minot. Christy, describe for our listeners what a classroom looks like now where you teach.
Boy, yeah, our classrooms now, they sure look a lot different than they looked this spring, you know, prior to March. Right now, we have done the best that we can do to spread all of our tables around, our desks around. We have created areas in our classrooms where students can, you know, take a mask break and still stay safe. A lot of the stuff that we had from home, because most teachers really build their classroom to look perfect for their students, to be that community feel. And so most of our classrooms don't look anything like they looked this spring. But we just, like I said, we need to do what we need to do to be able to continue to educate the kiddos. And we just have to do it safely.
Well, I remember when I was in school, it was the baby boom generation. So we had classrooms with 30, 35 kids in them. Nowadays, I think the teacher to student ratio is much more favorable. But how many students do you have in class? And do you have to prepare for class presentations that are online? Do you have some students who aren't in the room?
Well, that's actually a great question, because it really does vary from class to class. But ours, in my personal class, I have some bigger classes of 26 to 28. And, you know, there's other classes that have less than that, but it just really varies on what the topic is and how many teachers you have in those specific contents. For me personally, I don't have any distance learning kids yet this school year. In the secondary schools, they had to kind of go by numbers. They had to go by some special service classes. And so I personally myself don't have any distance learning, but I have lots of coworkers that are doing both inline teaching, or excuse me, both face-to-face teaching and online teaching.
I know there's been concern during the startup for this new school year about teachers of a certain age or maybe closer to retirement, maybe thinking this would be a good time to opt out. And I know in some areas of the state, for that matter, across the nation, there are some difficulties finding substitute teachers in case teachers aren't there or are ill. How would you describe the circumstances in your district?
You know, we definitely have a shortage of substitute teachers to come into our classroom, you know, especially because most of the subs that we have in the past are retired teachers, you know, that are looking to stick around and, you know, keep a foot in the education door. And us current teachers, we just really, really appreciate them coming back into the classroom when they come in with experience. So you're right, you know, a lot of our subs, they're not willing to risk their health just to come in and kind of keep that, you know, that current. So it has been a struggle to find substitute teachers in the district. It's been a struggle to find paraprofessionals, just because right now it's just so unknown, and some people just have to put their health as a priority over their career right now.
What other precautions are in place at your school? For example, for school lunches or for gym activities or Phi Ed, that kind of stuff.
Sure. So I know at lunch, they have arranged seating assignments. I do believe they got to pick those spots the first couple days, but then now they have to continue to sit with the same people every day, which isn't unusual. Students do that all the time. But they have to be... It's very hard for them to be able to do any type of switching because of contact tracing. In the classrooms, we have to have seating arrangements, which, to be quite honest, this is my 15th year teaching, and I can't remember a time that I've actually had a seating arrangement in my class. So this is probably the first time I've had to do that, and it breaks my heart that I'm doing it, because we need to know if somebody's sitting less than 6 feet away from somebody else. As far as PE, they have to wear their masks to class. I know our PE teachers in my school have just been so amazing and been able to try and, you know, fit everybody in a place in the gym so that they can be far enough apart to take those mask breaks. And so far, as long as the weather cooperates, you know, they can get outside as well. But who knows, I guess now once the weather starts to turn cold and they're going to be in the building, I'm sure they're going to have to do a lot of adjusting.
Christy Reinke is the Teacher of the Year for North Dakota. Christy, obviously you got the attention of the professionals in your profession to give you this honor. How would you describe your teaching style? Why do you think they chose you?
This is a really hard question for me to answer because, I mean, I walk down the halls in my school and I'm just in awe at everybody and how they're teaching and what they're doing with kids. So I just have a really hard time figuring out that I'm doing anything different than they're doing in their classroom. I know personally, my philosophy in my classroom is to create a sense of community. I teach seventh graders and they all turn into teenagers right before yeah. my eyes. And, you know, they think at that point they're adults and they get to make their own decisions. So I just let them sometimes make their decisions. I want them to take ownership in their teaching. And so they pride themselves on being able to do that. And as a result, I think I'm able to form a pretty darn good relationship with them. And once they see that I trust them and I feel like they can be independent, I really truly feel like they are more willing to work for me. They want to succeed. And so I don't know that that's any different than any other teacher is doing. But I know in my class, it's we're a big community.
When I was a student, it was the teacher and then the class. It was like a kind of a lecture approach to education, a lot of rote learning. Nowadays, isn't it more collaborative, more hands-on, more interactive?
Absolutely. I mean, that is one thing that I love to do in my class. We do a ton of collaboration. We do a ton of group work. Oftentimes we put the textbook aside and we just try to get outside of our four walls, and not physically, but we take the classroom and, you know, with the invention of technology and we Skype other classrooms around the world. And it's such a fun opportunity for students to actually get to see and ask questions to people from other areas of the country, other areas of the world, and learn about their culture directly from them. It's so much better, in my opinion, than just reading about the culture. But let's actually talk to somebody who's living it, who's breathing it. And I feel like when we get to do stuff like that or bring in guest speakers, I just feel like the kids just soak it in so much more than just reading out of a textbook and doing a worksheet or taking a test. I just really try to bring in other ways to assess knowledge and make sure that the students are still learning their state standards. But I try to do it in a way where, you know, they don't even realize that I'm assessing them.
So you've had these Skype conversations with other classrooms in the world?
Actually, a colleague of mine, I used to teach both at Ramsted and Jim Hill, and a colleague of mine, Rochelle Lemoore is her name, she had been doing these mystery Skypes in her classroom. And so when I started teaching with her, she said, give it a try. I think you'll really love it. The students love it. And we tried it once or twice and just got hooked on it. So I contact other teachers from around the world. Literally, I mean, we've Skyped classes in France and Spain and the Dominican Republic and Mexico and Brazil. And we find these other classes. And so we do sort of this back and forth guessing game where we are using all of our geography knowledge to try and guess and locate where they are somewhere around in the world and vice versa. And so it's just such a cool thing because then afterwards they can ask questions and they love to ask questions like, well, what's the weather right now outside your window? Or, you know, we were Skyping with a class in Hawaii and they said, what'd you guys eat for lunch today? And couldn't believe they got fresh fish that was just caught that morning. You know, and we had, you know, chicken nuggets. And I mean, it's just so fun.
There's a several hour difference between here in Hawaii or here in Spain. So are you getting them in the early, early morning in Hawaii or in the late afternoon in Spain?
Well, yeah. So both, I guess. I mean, in Hawaii, I'll have to do it with like my afternoon classes because, you know, they're on, a totally different time zone than us. So it'll be like their first hour of the day and I'll have to get it with my seventh hour of the day. Or when we do other classes, I have found when we do other classes around the world, oftentimes I'll do like a community college where they're practicing their English. And so it'll be adults that are taking like evening classes. And so they use us to practice their English and we use them to practice our geography. So it's sort of a win-win, but scheduling them is definitely the most challenging part of these Skypes.
You said something rather interesting a minute ago, and that was that they're interacting in these Skypes, they're having these conversations, not aware perhaps that you're evaluating them. That gets us to that other point. Back in my day, it was a test here, a test there, a test, you know, it was rote learning mostly. Nowadays, mm-hmm. How do you go about effectively evaluating each individual student?
Yeah, that's a great question. And obviously, every teacher has sort of their own take on it. And don't get me wrong, sometimes paper tests are the way to go. And I will acknowledge that and that happens. But for me, if I can see a student, if my goal is for students to understand where locations are in the world, you know, if they can get on this Skype and say questions like, you know, are you north of the equator? You know, are you in the Western hemisphere? Are you above, you know, a certain latitude or longitude line? Or they'll say, you know, are you east of the Mississippi? Those questions to me, if they can do that in real life, that means so much more than them seeing a piece of paper and, you know, closing their eyes and trying to, you know, figure out or guess the answer or just memorizing it. So I like them to show me in the real world, can they, you know, figure out stuff like that?
You mentioned that you were a special education teacher for years before you got into the social studies curriculum, if you will. That raises some other issues. During the pandemic, how are special education students being helped? And for that matter, I've always wondered, considering the severe disruption that occurred in the spring and everything went online, how much review have you had to do? Where are your students and where you would anticipate them to be at this point in the school year?
Sure, that's a great question too. I'm actually going to answer that two different ways, if you don't mind. I mean, the first part of how were, a lot of the students, especially if it was a student with a special need, how were they, helped during the pandemic? And I've got to tell you that our special ed department, whether it was the teachers, whether it was the paraprofessionals, they really had to be creative how they would serve their students during this time. I know a lot of it was a lot of one-on-one, still over the computer, but they had to, still help them out that way. And so I know they were working overtime. They were working extra just to make sure that those students were still getting that help that they have. And as far as, now coming back to school, personally, in my class, I haven't noticed a lot of regression. But again, my class isn't necessarily, it's a new class for them. Most of them are just learning geography for the first time. They'll dabble in things like latitude and longitude and compass rows in elementary school, but a lot of this cultural material and physical geography we teach, it's all brand new anyway. If you were to talk to maybe a math teacher or a language arts teacher, they could probably tell you more whether or not they've seen any type of regression during the pandemic or during the summer. But to be quite honest, that's something that happens every summer with a lot of kids. And so teachers, every fall, we just know we've got to spend some time catching people up. We've got to spend some time, getting them to where they need to be. And in a typical classroom, you'll probably never have all your students at the same ability level anyway. And so that's just something teachers do. We teach, to five different ability levels every hour of every day. And so, I guess I haven't personally noticed any regression, but it started the same way with me this fall than it normally does.
Christy Reinke, North Dakota's Teacher of the Year. You have the most important occupation in the world. I often think that because I can't tell you who won an Academy Award last year, but I can certainly tell you all about some teachers I had. And that brings me to the point that you've been in this business long enough where you've had students who've graduated from college. Tell us about the rewards, the continuing rewards, if you will, of being a teacher.
Oh, definitely the rewards of being a teacher. It is no teacher enters the profession planning to get rich. We all enter the profession knowing that we're going to make a difference in the life of everybody that we are around. I mean, every single profession has to go through our profession to get there. And it's just such a great thing. Recently, I've had a lot of former students reach out after, the announcement especially, and just tell me stories or tell me things that they remembered about my class. And it's just such a cool thing to get to know that there's these grown adults that you affected. Because as a teacher, we just show up every day, we teach our content, we build relationships. But I don't think that it totally sinks in how much of an impression we can make, good or bad, on the lives or the future of some of these students.
Well, you obviously made a very good impression. You will be a candidate for the National Teacher of the Year Award. Four finalists will be named in January. Christy Reinke with Jim Hill Middle School in Minot, North Dakota's Teacher of the Year. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for asking me. This is the first time I've done a radio interview over the phone.
Well,
Well,
you do very well. Thank you.
thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, Bill Thomas with the story of a North Dakota church's drive-in Easter service. And Matt Olean will tell us about a documentary movie featuring the late comedy star Peter Sellers. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota Women's Network organized rallies held in Bismarck and Fargo this afternoon, urging Senator John Hoeven to oppose plans to fill the Supreme Court seat held by the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Representatives from the network delivered letters to the senator's staff stating the issue and why any confirmation should wait until after the January inauguration. Sharon Boer and Madeline Luke drove from Valley City to take part in the rally in front of Hoeven's Fargo office. Bohr says even though the senator was not at his Fargo office, it is still important to take part in the event.
We believe in a democracy, and we feel that an appointment at this time of a justice is not in the democratic nature of our country.
Madeline Luke says her parents left China many years ago to escape chaos and find a better life. She says her involvement in the rally stems from the need to restore faith in the American dream.
They came to the United States because it was what the Cantonese call a Gemsan, Golden Mountain, promised land. And we have done very well here. We've educated ourselves. We're parts of all the communities that we live in all across the country. And it's because there's education, there's health care, there's rule of law. Most people are honest, and people take this very much for granted here. We can't take it for granted anymore. People must follow rules. People must follow laws. This is our biggest asset. This is why we're strong.
Senator Hovind has said because the presidency and Senate are controlled by the same party, there is precedent showing the confirmation should proceed. He says if the two parties split the control, then it should be up to the voters to decide. A Kentucky-based drone manufacturing company has landed in Grand Forks. Last November, the Grand Forks City Council approved a $400,000 loan to assist the company Mobile Recon in the move. Mobile Recon also received $400,000 from the North Dakota Development Fund and utilized a $400,000 private bank loan to bring the corporate headquarters to Grand Forks. Drones developed by the company can lift up to 200 pounds. The company expects to create 13 jobs in the Grand Forks area. And enrollment in the North Dakota university system this fall is 98% of the count 1 year ago, or 44,001 students. NDUS researchers anticipated a 4% drop because of the pandemic and fewer high school graduates this past spring. The director of institutional research, Dr. Jan Weber, says the numbers match up with what is happening across the country.
A report released by the National Student Clearinghouse, which was an initial look, you know, across the country of what's going on in higher ed. And they reported what they're seeing is about a 2.5% decrease in the number of undergrads and a 3.9% increase in the number of graduate students. So I think we're seeing the same thing going on.
Weber told members of the North Dakota Board of Higher Education Thursday first year and transfer student numbers were down, but graduate students were up significantly. She says the census count also finds 35% of students are going to school part-time. UND's fall enrollment was 13,615 students, and NDSU was 12,846. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Race is at the core of every issue this election year, from healthcare to the economy. And for a lot of folks, that's too uncomfortable to talk about. But I'm talking about it. I'm Rebecca Carroll, the host of Come Through from WNYC Studios. Join me for conversations with brilliant thinkers and activists, Issa Rae, Don Lemon, Gabrielle Union, and others. Where is this country headed? Find out. Come through.
Come through. This week's Prairie Public presents Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The pandemic has disrupted pretty much everything we try to do together, like church services. As a result, precautions, masks and distancing and hand washing have become routine. Sometimes the challenge, like gathering for an important religious holiday, requires thinking outside the box. Our Bill Thomas tells the story.
It's the spring of 2020, and a pastor in southwest North Dakota wants to do a safe Easter service. He calls on a band for help, a band of brothers. Here's Matthew Musakia, who looked into what happened for the North Dakota Council on the Arts.
When Easter Sunday rolled around this year, coronavirus restrictions caused church services across North Dakota to become silent. However, musician Seth Waddington of Regent, North Dakota, and his brothers still found themselves playing church music and hymns to a large crowd, using a radio transmitter and a parking lot. A bluegrass musician, Waddington, 32, plays the guitar in a regional band, the Waddington Brothers, and describes the music as both traditional but with Western music influences, closer to both the cowboy songs that became popular in the 1940s and 1950s, and bluegrass rather than to the country Western genre. Appropriately enough to the name, this group consists of himself and his brothers, twins Ethan, banjo, and Jacob, mandolin, both 29, and Job, 15, on bass. Originally from Montana, the band has toured parts of the United States and Canada. But before that, they traveled extensively with his family's band, often playing churches and bluegrass festivals. Waddington said he was initially skeptical of playing when local pastor Corey Warner asked him to perform a drive-in concert on Easter Sunday. Originally, the idea was pitched that they would play with speakers, and cars would roll down their windows and listen. However, given his long experience on stage, Waddington thought that idea would not work because without an incredible amount of speakers, they could not get decent coverage for the entire crowd. The idea, inspired by Christmas time and suggested by Waddington's wife, Rachel, was based on lights synchronized to music so that a listener could tune in using his or her car's radio. So we were pondering it. We liked the idea, but I didn't really think it was feasible until the idea of the FM transmitter came up, Waddington said. I had never seen one. We looked around a little bit online, and sure enough, they were pretty readily available. The service took place on Easter Sunday at the fairgrounds at Mott, North Dakota. Based on photos and estimates from a friend, Waddington believes that about 60 to 65 cars were present and could have equaled about a crowd of 125 people. The event generally followed a similar format to most Sunday Easter services. In this case, two pastors gave the readings and the sermon, and Waddington said that he and his brothers played about 30 minutes of music, featuring hymns such as He Lives, and Where is the Lamb, and The Gift to Believe. Instead of applause, cars would honk their horns, even the ones about 8 to 10 feet from the stage, which Waddington described as pretty loud and kind of funny. That was one that kind of caught us off guard, as a surprise, he said. It lightened the mood and was a nice way for the crowd to respond to let us know they were enjoying or approving of what we were doing. I told my brothers we should do this all the time. I kind of like that. Waddington said the turnout was better than expected, and the positive response included many phone calls and text messages. After having to cancel their own concerts, Waddington said the concert was a very good experience. I was very honored, I guess, that many people would want to come out to listen to us sing while they sat in their cars, said Waddington. It was an honor to be able to play for people, even though they couldn't come sit in a chair and I couldn't see them right in the face and speak to them. I guess it was a blessing to be able to go out and still share our music and get to have an Easter service with the community and fellowship, which is what everyone enjoys and is used to.
And this is some music by the Waddington Brothers. You can find this online, Less Traveled Road. And that was Matthew Musakia talking about the Waddington Brothers and their participation in that Easter service in the spring of 2020. Now, this intrigued me enough that I wanted to talk a little more about it, so I got hold of a Waddington. I reached Seth Waddington, the guitar player, and he told me that the day of that service, they almost weren't able to go on.
Yes, just before people started arriving, the upright bass that my youngest brother Job plays, the end pin, the stick that the bass stands on essentially, and that's what holds the tailpiece on, which holds the strings, it just broke in two, and so we essentially had a useless bass. But I had a really good friend in town, and I called him and I told him I need a pair of pliers and a broomstick and a pair of spaghetti tongs, and he rounded up this kind of mismatched array of tools and brought them to me, and we were able to take the broomstick and insert it in the hole for the bass to stand on again and wrap the cable for the tailpiece around it, and my brother Jacob took the spaghetti tongs and went through the F hole, the sound hole there, and was able to kind of wedge the sound post. There's a post in the that goes under the foot of the bridge to help the top deal with the string tension, and we were able to kind of jimmy-rig everything back together and get it back tuned up and on stage just barely in time to do the show. So
I asked Seth if he knew of anyone else who'd used this mini FM transmitter technique.
You know, I haven't heard of anyone else doing that. It just kind of came about by accident. You know, when Pastor Corey called, we thought this sounds like a great idea, but you know, there's no way you'd have to have an amazing amount of speakers to cover a parking lot like that with people in the vehicle. I think it was my wife who suggested the radio, and I said, well, that would work, but then, you know, we'd have to be in a studio somewhere. And a good friend of ours from Bismarck was the one who actually told us of the existence of these little transmitters. I didn't know they had such a thing. And we hunted around the community, and a guy in the neighborhood had one and loaned it to us. And I don't know, it was just it was kind of a neat thing because it was really sort of a community effort. You know, Pastor Corey had the idea, and it just sort of evolved into the FM transmitter, you know, concert.
And they have continued to use that?
I don't believe they are now, but when restrictions were a little stiffer, Pastor Corey did continue having church services in the park and using the transmitter, so they were able to continue their regular Sunday morning services.
The Lord helps those who help themselves. Well, it seemed like such a good idea. Of course, I asked Seth if they've done it again.
You know, we haven't. We would have liked to, and we actually had some interest and some invitations. But unfortunately, my two of my brothers at this point live in northwestern Montana, and they had to return home for work. And so we weren't able to pursue the FM transmitter concerts anymore after that initial Easter service.
Seth Waddington explained to me that when they were younger, their parents had had them in a family band, and now the brothers were spread apart, not able to play together that much. But
just are feeling like it's time to start doing music again, and really miss getting to go out and see our friends and meet people and to share the music. I don't know, I think it's kind of funny, but I think sometimes people don't realize how much the musicians need the audience, more than the audience maybe needs the musicians. It's just a very rewarding thing to get to go out and share this sort of thing with people.
Well, and that's just regular performance. Having to scramble to meet the needs of a crisis to present a beloved service adds another dimension.
I guess I feel like with this whole coronavirus that we've been dealing with, you know, community is what's really suffered. You know, it's just hard to get out and see people, and just kind of everybody has cabin fever at this point, I think. And I don't know, it was just really nice to be able to be involved in some sort of a community event where people were still able to come out and participate in at least a small way, and we were able to be a part of that, and just very grateful for that.
That's Seth Waddington of the Waddington Brothers Band. And the story of he and his brothers and that unusual service out in Mott, North Dakota, is from a project called Little Stories of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. You can find more about it and many other things at arts.nd.gov. I'm Bill Thomas.
Prairie Public's Director of Radio, Bill Thomas. Next on Main Street, our Friday film review from Matt O'Lean.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
What's it like to live in the woods alone, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest hole for over 2,000 miles. Hey, North Dakota, I'm Glenn Washington. Experience amazing stories from the people who live them on Snap Judgment. Join me every Saturday in Prairie Public for Snap. Snap Judgment airs Saturday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Mountain on Prairie Public.
Then at 6 p.m. Central, it's LiveWire with me, your host, Luke Burbank. Each week on our show, we talk to all kinds of folks, writers, actors, artists, comedians. Plus, we've got live music, and we even like to hear from you. Yes, you, the Prairie Public listener. You're going to have your chance to chime in as well. It's all the fun of a live event. Remember those? Those were awesome. All from the safety and comfort of your radio. Don't miss LiveWire, Saturday nights at 6 Central, following Snap Judgment on Prairie Public.
There's the fanfare. It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean. And Matt, did you actually go into a movie theater this week, or is this a documentary you saw online?
I skipped the theaters this week, Doug, because there was really nothing to see. So I watched a documentary on Prime Video called The Ghost of Peter Sellers. And this is a fascinating look at an ill-fated movie that was made in 1973 called Ghost in the Noonday Sun, which was never released. And this was a film directed by Peter Medak, who was a Hungarian film director. Doug, you may remember him as the director of The Ruling Class with Peter O'Toole, Day in the Death of Joe Egg with Alan Bates. And so he was on a real roll at this time in the early 70s with back-to-back hits. And the documentary is made by Peter Medak himself. He goes back and tries to recount what happened and how this film nearly ruined his career, thanks to the enormous ego of the star, Peter Sellers. And so he talks to people who were involved in the film. He talks to the producer, John Heyman, who wanted to fire Medak at the time when things weren't going well. And it's really a fascinating look back at a time when a star could really bankroll a film just on their name alone. And so just some backstory here, Doug, the documentary looks great. I mean, it's fantastically shot. It's got a high gloss feel to it. It feels a little scripted, like Peter Medak is kind of, he kind of knows the ending of this documentary and he's kind of scripting it along and making it touching and humorous. But the film revolves around a moment when in London, Peter Sellers came up to Peter Medak and he had been very impressed with The Ruling Class, which was the O'Toole picture I told you about. And he said, "Darling, let's make a movie. We're going to make a comedy set in the 17th century about pirates." And it was a script by his good buddy Spike Milligan. And Doug, you know Spike Milligan was in The Goons with Peter Sellers. They were old friends.
Yes.
So they had the script, they had the star, and suddenly they had $2.5 million to go to Cyprus to shoot this movie. And they probably should never have made the movie, because once they got there, it almost becomes impossible to explain how things happened, but it happened. This is how it happened. They had this pirate ship built. They brought it into the harbor the first day of shooting, and the captain of the ship was drunk, and he hit the rocks, and he damaged the boat. So then they had to fix the boat. Every day when they'd go out to shoot on the sea, the motor would break, and two brothers from Cyprus, the Costa brothers, would have to come out in their boat and tow this huge boat into the harbor for the night. Peter Sellers faked a heart attack during one part of the movie so he could go to London and party and get out of making the movie. And he had a doctor sign a fake thing that he'd had a heart attack. And, you know, Sellers had heart problems. So it was just one thing after another. Sellers wanted to fire Medak at some point. The producers wanted Medak fired. There were cost overruns, delays, days when Sellers refused to shoot scenes. Finally, his old buddy Spike Milligan was brought in to kind of help direct some scenes and kind of turned it into a Monty Python-esque thing. But it turned out so bad, and you see enough clips in this movie of the actual movie to realize how bad it was. Sellers overacts tremendously, that it was never released.
The Ghost of Peter Sellers is the movie. It came out in 2018, and as you mentioned, Matt, or hint at, Peter Sellers didn't just have a drinking problem and an occasional heart problem. He had emotional and mental difficulties as well.
So Peter Medak in this show talks to people that had warned him that Sellers was hard to work with, but he felt he could tangle him. He'd worked well with Peter O'Toole in The Ruling Class, who could be hard to work with as well. So he felt he could wrangle the star, but it turned out to be a disaster. A couple of humorous parts, Doug. Sellers' character name in the movie is a humorous yet vulgar character name that I can't repeat, but maybe you've looked it up online and know what his character's name is. It's quite humorous. The other thing that's funny is the plot of the film, Ghost in the Noonday Sun. Sellers plays the cook on this ship, and eventually he tries to become the captain, and there's buried treasure, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on. Anthony Franciosa was in this movie. He and Sellers hated each other by the end of the movie so badly that they had to film a dueling scene with swords, and they would not appear in the same scene together. So he had to Peter Medak had to cut that together. Peter Boyle is in the movie. I mean, there's some big stars in this, but it just shows you how difficult and risky it is to make movies on location, especially when the star has an ego. And Peter Medak is very good in the film. He talks about, you know, he's not making this film to trash Peter Sellers' memory because he considers him a genius and he loved him. And they actually made up about 5 years after the disastrous shooting. They ran into each other in London when Sellers was shooting another Pink Panther movie. And they made quite a night of it. And all was forgotten, and Sellers had no memory of all the misbehaviors that he had done. Stars get away with a lot, as you know, Doug. But it's a fascinating watch to really go back to a time when there was too much money to spend and stars could get a film made just on their name.
Well, Peter Sellers died at a relatively young age, actually, and he had a fantastic movie career in terms of the movies, the Pink Panther series and all that stuff. I mean, he was a huge name when he was in the 70s, but he had difficulties. I know he has family difficulties. He had multiple wives. He had problems with his kids in terms of the relationship he had with them. So kind of a difficult life and perhaps not uncommon for comics to have this complicated back life.
And in this documentary, Doug, Peter Medak interviews Peter Sellers' daughter, Victoria. He interviews people that worked with Peter Sellers. He interviews his body double. These people are still alive, and they all say the same thing. Like Victoria Sellers says, you know, he always had a new woman with him every time I would see him as a kid. And that's just the way it was. And
he fell in love with Sophia Loren.
Yeah, but that was unrequited. She did not return that love. They made the millionaires together. Yes, he was infatuated with her, but why would she leave her powerful husband, Carlo Ponte, for this British comedian? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of interesting interviews. Robert Wagner's in it, who made the Pink Panther with Peter Sellers. People that worked with him talk about how difficult it was, yet they all acknowledge he was a genius. And one of the interviewers says he clearly had something undiagnosed, some kind of manic thing that caused him to act this way. So a fascinating human being, of course, great comic actor, made a lot of bad movies, made some great ones, of course, Dr. Strangelove being there and a few others. But what he did to Peter Medak was almost ruin his career, if you believe what he's recounting. And there's no reason not to believe it because everybody who's involved in this documentary has the same memories of making the film, that it was a disaster and Sellers had it out for the director.
The documentary is titled The Ghost of Peter Sellers. And where can people see it again, Matt?
On Prime Video.
All right. You mentioned a couple of movies. Mm-hmm. I was surprised when I was reminding myself of Peter Sellers, because I went to a lot of his films, as most people did at that time, that he never won an Academy Award. And you mentioned two movies that he was nominated for Best Actor in a Leading Role, and that was Being There and Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
And it is, to me, surprising that neither one of those roles actually took home the gold statue. But so let's do a little history here. Dr. Strangelove came out in 1964, so it would have been eligible for the 65 Oscars. Who won Best Actor in a Leading Role in 1965?
That was Rex Harrison and My Fair Lady.
Well done. And Being There was on screen in 1979, so it was up in front of the 1980 Oscars. Who won Best Actor in a Leading Role in 1980?
Dustin Hoffman and Kramer versus Kramer. And Sellers should have won. He should have won for one of those roles for sure.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
I'm Scott Yu. Come with me to discover Franz Schubert, one of our most inspirational composers.
His music is quite supernatural.
Schubert was that shift from classical to romantic.
Get to know the spirit of his work with a new generation of musicians. The Schubert Generation. On Now Hear This, on Great Performances.
Watch Great Performances, The Schubert Generation, tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 25th. John Burke was born in Iowa in 1859 and earned a law degree at the University of Iowa. He relocated to North Dakota and began his political career in 1891 when he was elected to the North Dakota House of Representatives. He went on to serve in the state Senate and then as Rolette County Judge. In 1906, he earned the Democratic nomination for governor and was elected. On this date in 1908, the Devil's Lake Interocean took issue with Burke. The newspaper said Burke fell short of what was required of a governor of a great state. In particular, the newspaper said Burke had campaigned on promises that he knew he could not fulfill. One of Burke's promises was that he would enforce prohibition laws. The newspaper said Burke had failed, with the state seeing no decrease in prohibition violations. Burke, in turn, blamed the state's attorney and the city of Dickinson for refusing to enforce prohibition laws. He said he did not have the authority to remove those officers, and therefore he said, "My hands are tied." Burke didn't seem to be overly concerned with prohibition. In a meeting with other governors, he reported that, "We have had prohibition so long in North Dakota that in some counties there are no jails. There is not much crime in the state." Burke proved popular with voters. In spite of the criticisms voiced in some newspapers, Burke won re-election in 1898 and again in 1910. He's known for establishing a state tuberculosis sanitarium, strengthening child labor laws, and the creation of a juvenile court system. Following Burke's tenure as governor, President Wilson appointed him as Treasurer of the United States. His signature appears on all U.S. currency printed for the next 8 years. Burke then served as judge on the North Dakota Supreme Court, a position he held until his death in 1913. And he's honored with a statue in Statuary Hall at the United States Capitol. Burke County is named in his honor. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The latest on the Supreme Court is a nominee is about to be named, and two divas finally have an audience.
It's going to be really exciting, of course, to see smiling faces that are going to absorb all of this beautiful music with messaging behind it and lots of memories.
Vanessa Williams and Renee Fleming, and the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thanks for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. After the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Monday on Main Street, East Grand Forks native Dan Hendrickson has released a book titled Comedy Album, a collection of comedic verse. On Monday, he'll join us to talk about his creation and share an excerpt or two or three or four. And the North Dakota Woman of the Year banquet will honor Susan Wiefald of Bismarck. Ashley Thornburg spoke with Wiefald earlier this year. We will revisit that conversation. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.